Breakthrough Coach on Your Mental Health. Today, I have a very unique guest, Cherise Krall. Cherise worked in the Defence Force for almost a decade in aviation as a crew chief. She specializes in communication and leadership, and she helps veterans start businesses by equipping them with the skills to communicate effectively and have intentional conversations. Now, there's a lot of parallels in this talk that we're about to have, and that is the transitioning period from a very unique industry to land-based. And we are going to discuss what that experience is like and how you can make that smooth transition. So welcome, Cherise. Thank you for joining me today.
It's not a problem. Thanks for having me.
So you have been working in aviation for a decade. Is that correct?
Yes, I was just shy of 10 years. So it's easier just to say it.
And what made you choose this industry?
That's a great question. For me, I had a lot of friends who went into the military when I was young, and my uncle used to fly fighter jets in the Air Force, F-16s, and just that power in that machine, it got to me, and I just fell in love. Well, he talked me out of being a pilot for F-16s because it destroyed his body completely, and he just didn't want that for me because it just hurt so bad. And so I did the next best thing, and I went into the Army and started working with helicopters, Black Hawks specifically.
Mm. Gosh, and you have been all over. I know you mentioned Jordan, Kuwait, Iraq. Mm-hmm. What other destinations have you visited?
Oh, gosh. I'll probably miss a few, but I've been to Panama a few times. I worked with the Canadian forces a lot and the British forces over in Germany. We went to Iraq, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is probably the scariest time for us because we were right on the border and there were hits out for American soldiers. And so we had to really stay covered and watch out. But thankfully, none of my service and time dealt with direct combat. It was more picking up the pieces after that or bringing in special forces to deal with a situation or a mission. So there's a lot of being close to it secondhand, but not having to deal with a lot of the direct effects.
Okay. But your lives could still be at risk in terms of going to.
Oh, very.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh, you're very brave. How do you feel before going into one of those areas, knowing that your life is at risk? How do you cope with that?
You know, the military does a lot of very good training to handle situations, and it just boils down to practice makes perfect. So your emotions are unreasonable. And so if you want to be able to perform in a high stress environment, then you need to practice over and over and over again so that your body can kick into action automatically and do what needs to be done when your emotions are going berserk, you know, and just not able to control themselves.
Yes. I remember a TED talk, and I don't know if you've seen this one, but it's this particular soldier went to his fellow, I wouldn't know the term, how you would call it.
Oh, you're fine.
Pardon?
You're fine. I don't, okay. It doesn't bother me at all.
He was on his deathbed and he whispered some words to him, and I think it was like, it was very powerful and it went all over the news, but because it's so long ago that I had watched it, I can't remember exactly. But do you recall anything like that? I know it's very brief and broad, but
thankfully we have had a lot of my close friends I've been on a couple deployments, and some of the people from my first deployment have died, some of them very sudden, and some of them overseas, some of them, you know, back home. So we've dealt with a lot of loss. And when I was deployed, we had to transport bodies of soldiers and people we knew to another base to prepare to go home. And that's very eye-opening. It really puts you into perspective of how easy it is to die. And so then you start looking at things differently. But thankfully, I've never had to console someone or talk to someone as they're dying or deal with that. I'm very happy about that.
Yeah. So you're probably surrounded by that sense of grief and loss 24/7. in almost a decade. And I know you've been taught the skills to manage that, but do you have your go-to toolkit that you use to cope?
That's a great question. The military does an amazing job teaching you how to handle the situation itself. Mm-hmm. It does a horrible job teaching you how to handle it after the fact or your emotions. Mm-hmm. So that's why in America we have 22 veterans a day commit suicide, which is an astounding number because there isn't a very good transition with dealing with your emotions. Because in the military, emotions are weak. And so my leadership training and being able to work with John Maxwell has helped a lot with that. And to a point, anything having to do with sudden loss or loss in general, the only thing that's going to fix it is time. And for some people, being able to handle those situations is different than other people. So for me, I will not go to the funeral. I can't. I will not go. Some people have to go to the funeral to be able to have that closure. For me, it's replaying and relaying that information of that person is gone over and over and over in my head to kind of numb myself to the shock, because the actual effect is not as bad as the shock of the change. Mm-hmm. And that's just a personality thing, I believe. So it's different for each person, but when you're dealing with being able to communicate with people and understanding people's emotions, having somebody talk through it is a huge help because it kind of brings it from that shock point into reality. And then just thinking about all the positives of how that person affected your life, some great stories, you know, just some common things. Those simple prodding your emotions to get into this idea and this pattern of this is how realistic it is now, or this is what the world is now, really helps put your emotions into check.
It's really interesting because I spent a day with some veterans because I was very curious, purely because of the fact of the, as you said, the high suicide rate. In Australia, it's not as bad, but it's 7. And that's still more than what it ever should be. But yeah, I spent the day with them. We're having conversations and they were on disability. What's the word? Disability. See, it's too early in the morning for me.
Compensation?
Yeah, from the government. And the partners went to war together and their son is now on ICE and they were dealing with all of that. And he was dealing with post-traumatic stress. And she was the one that was, I guess, holding everyone and taking care of everyone. And she even had a business where she, I think it was like Salvation, Salvos, we call it in Australia, where you got the secondhand clothes and she would employ veterans to come work in the shop. And it just seemed like she was giving and doing so much. And I just said to her, but who's taking care of you? And then she got all choked up and she couldn't speak and she left and she went to the bathroom. I think to have that private space to cry. And it's so interesting that you say that, you know, you can't show, you know, emotions as a sign of weakness and you can't show your emotions at work. And so we suppress them and then they come out in other ways. And maybe that's something that you deal with the communication, is that it's just maybe all the emotions are sitting up there, and to actually communicate pro-socially can be challenging.
Very much so. And a lot of it does have to do with PTSD related events. And so sometimes you can't control it if it's really bad. Or sometimes if you've learned the skill sets to control it by your therapist or counselor, then you still have the emotions. They're still going on inside you. You just kind of shut down on the outside. And so it's really hard for veterans to connect in the civilian world, because when we go into and work with other people who don't have that experience, that intense change or almost brainwashing training to think a certain way, act a certain way. When you're working with people like that, they don't know how to connect with you because they know nothing about the situation. And so then their first response is to treat you like an alien and back away or not try to build that connection. And so it's almost the veteran's job to reach out a little bit more if they want to create a connection with people. But we're never taught how to do that. And like what you're saying, when you're dealing with these intense emotions of frustration or anger or sadness or dealing with, you know, people dying even years after you've gotten out, you know, hearing friends who stayed in and they've died, or especially when it's your job. So like as a crew chief, I flew right behind the pilots in these helicopters and they crash all the time. And I just found out that a friend of mine that I used to go to training with some years ago that I absolutely loved, I just found out last week that she had died back in 2017 and I had never known about it. And it was due to her helicopter going down on the coast of Hawaii. And it was just, it sucked. And so then when you're in the middle of working with clients or working with a network of people professionally, and you just find that out during lunch and you have to go back and deal with them, there's a lot of emotions that you are feeling, and you have to be able to communicate and work with people around those emotions. And, you know, and then a lot of things that other veterans deal with having to do with these emotions is frustration and anger. And that comes from working with people who haven't been trained. And so when you're used to these people making instant responses, and we call it high speed action, you know, working very quickly, making a move, making a decision quickly, not complaining about something, just doing the work, that kind of thing. And then you work with people who haven't been trained to do that. It's not bad, but they just have a different process. It takes a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. And so you get frustrated quickly because things aren't getting done, or people are sensitive because you talk to them too directly and they took it offensively, or that you hurt their feelings. And so there's a lot of different things you have to work around because of your training.
Yes. So knowing what you know now, if you had to return to the Defense Force and deliver training around communication, obviously their strategy is to build yourself, your resilience, so that you can move forward with the operation. So knowing what you know now and the impact of maybe suppressing your emotions or putting them aside, and I know that serves a purpose in war, but would you change anything in how it's conducted?
What I would change the most, and one of the sole reasons I started this business, is for this purpose, to be able to go in and help change the leadership specifically. Because a lot of times people believe, and especially in this situation where emotions are weakness, people believe that they can be a bully or not be attentive to the emotions at all. And as a great leader, you need to understand your people, which means also understanding their emotions. Yeah. And I don't mean catering to them, but being able to understand at a certain level and being able to build that trust and that respect up so that you do have influence over them, instead of just throwing your position or your rank at them and, you know, just demanding that they follow you because that's how the military works. So that is probably the biggest thing I would like to change. With communication specifically, that's a hard thing because of what you just said. There is a time and place and a reason we need to be trained a certain way. And so coming in and trying to change that, what are the after effects going to be? Are we not going to build strong soldiers? Is that going to be an after effect? Because we can't have that. So there is a fine line, and a lot of other veterans that work with transitioning soldiers to the civilian world, we are working together actively right now to kind of come up with an answer for that.
Yeah.
And we don't know the details yet, but it does have to do with more awareness and understanding emotions. You can learn to put them aside and you don't have to necessarily cater to them, but you have to understand them to be able to control them.
Yeah, and I think what struck a chord with me is the definition of strong. Like, what does that exactly mean? And maybe it's not building strong leaders, but emotionally intelligent leaders.
I love that. There is definitely a mental strength and a physical strength. And at least in the US here, we focus a lot more on the physical strength and mental numbness, not necessarily mental strength.
Yeah. And I used to work in the justice system in the prisons, and the one officer told me she had to attend a suicide and she had to cut the rope. And I think the guy ended up being a vegetable and he didn't complete suicide. And it was very traumatic for her to do something like that. And there was another incident, and this is a little bit visual for sensitive listeners. You may want to put your fingers in your ears. But I saw this particular inmate in the hospital, and he's tried to take his life numerous times, like jumping off roofs. He's sliced off his ear. Like, he's done all sorts of self-harm, and he sliced, and I don't know how this works, but somehow he was able to open his stomach, and he put his hand, and this is through listening to another officer, so this information may be a bit distorted, but this is what I heard, put his hand through his stomach and took like a decomposed apple. And was like, or no, sorry, he was eating stuff from his stomach.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yeah, and then she said the next day at work, the officers said to her, do you want bolognese, Sarah? Like, and all she could think of, it was like mincemeat that she was seeing, and it just made her so ill. And she said the debrief for both incidences was like the superintendent would say, okay, this happened. Are you all good? Good, good. We can move on. And just brush it off. Yeah.
That's so sad. And I've worked with a police department on the civilian side here in St. Louis, Missouri, which is it's the second most dangerous city in the United States. And it's sometimes tied for first with Chicago. and I was in a nicer area, but we've dealt with a lot of things like that, where we had this one really traumatic double homicide that we had to work. And looking at how they do post-training for the military in a situation like that versus post-training for police officers was very different. And with this double homicide, the police officers had mandatory 3 sessions with a psychologist that they had to sit down and go to. And then they would be reassessed after that. If they were fine, that was it. If they weren't, then they needed to keep going to sessions for a few weeks or a few months or however long it took. With the military is exactly what you said. Well, are we good? Good, great. All right, sounds good. I don't want to have more on my record underneath this situation. I want to have a great, you know, whatever. A lot of times your battalion commander or the officer in charge, they want a good mission. They don't want to have any issues because it reflects on them. And so they'll always sweep it under the rug.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? And did you, because it's quite common in the yachting industry, where you refer to bullying and someone contacted me the other day and said that the captain is a misogynist. And then there's obviously sexual assault within the industry. Were you aware or experience anything like that?
My entire career was full of it. And we have different branches in the military. It's worse in the Marines and in the Army versus the Coast Guard and the Air Force. They handle, you know, female soldiers a lot better in that area. They call them airmen and all that, and it's a different title. But from the female side of it, there's a lot in the Army. And even even not talking about gender, there's a lot of harassment and issues that happen just because it's when you try to push down emotions and try to ignore them completely, it just creates an amazing opportunity for bad leadership. And one of the effects of bad leadership is having an environment that essentially condones those actions. And it's just a result, but it's inevitable if you don't have good leadership that's constantly combating it and thinking about it and being proactive about it.
So your transition period, did you get reach out for any support, or how did you cope with the transition?
So at least with us in the Army, because emotions are weakness, you are not a good soldier if you reach out for help. That is one of the worst things you can do. You are a piece of crap if you reach out for help. And that's a mindset that they instill in you while you're in service. And so, of course, you naturally take it outside of service when you transition into the civilian world. So it's very difficult to get veterans to understand and get through that process and change that training or that habit and tell them that they need to be able to reach out to help. They have to fix these issues. So you get assistance, or like for me with my transition, I got help from my husband at the time and my mom and family members, the few that I felt comfortable reaching out to. But you always downplay everything, of course, because you need to sound like you can handle things. You need to sound like you're strong and you're tough and resilient, like you said before. And so it is tough. And you get all of these questionnaires, and the VA hospital who picks you up after transition, it's the military hospital, they will always ask you how you are, but they never take into account that people aren't going to tell you the truth at first. And so the first questionnaires that you have, of course you're not thinking about suicide, of course you're not having difficulty transitioning, of course you don't have stress, even though all of those are true.
Oh my goodness, that is so interesting.
There's no help. Yeah, it's crazy.
And the obvious, once you know that mentality, of course it's going to permeate and come through. And yeah, whether you're seeing the GP or those support systems that you would naturally go to.
Right.
Yeah.
And they always, it's tough because then when you do reach out to them, they want to downplay it because they don't want to pay for it. And so then there's a lot of trying to prove that you're not telling a lie, that you actually do hurt or that you have this issue. And you're trying to deal with these essentially arguments with your doctor or with personnel, trying to tell them that you actually do need help and they don't want to help you at first, because there are people that just want to get money and they don't have a lot of money to dish out in the first place.
Yes.
So that's another problem.
Yes. And I think it's the same here in Australia.
It's so sad. I think that's, I have some friends in Germany and in Canada. They're in the military there. And they have the same issue. So I almost think it's a worldwide military construct.
Yes. And so frustrating, because it feels like, I think for both of us, the answer is so clear. And it's why can't you implement these skill sets and these leadership qualities to support people, whether they're in the industry at the time or are exiting?
I agree completely. They really are failing in that transitional situation. So hopefully as things go and more veterans start building businesses like I have and start working together to push this, things might change.
Beautiful. So with regards to your insight working in the Air Force and then transitioning to civilian life, what would you say you'd put in your first aid kit in terms of helping yourself?
I love that. That's a really fun question because I've never heard that before or thought about it. I think that the first things, if I could do it all over again, the first thing would be getting a purpose in mind, deciding what your purpose in the civilian world is going to be. Because when you leave, there's two major things that you are losing suddenly. One is a direct sense of purpose, and the other is a very strong knit community. So those are the first things you need to replace. You need to figure out, okay, what am I good at? What am I passionate about? And how can I use those two things to help somebody? Because that's what a business is, helping somebody, right? And if you can create value in other people's lives somehow in a monetary fashion, then you are replacing your purpose as long as you're passionate about it. If you're not, then it's just another job.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is to find a community. And that can be a group of five friends that are thinking and feeling the same way you are. Some people who are, they have to be going somewhere. They have to be focusing on the future and their purpose and trying to better themselves. Mm-hmm. And then two, they need to be consistent and reliable. And mm-hmm. sometimes that can be hard with veterans when they're coming off of a whole bunch of crap and they're trying to deal with their holes mentally. I don't know how else to put it, but when you have to focus on yourself and become self-centered, you can't help other people. Yeah. And so when you are around other people and creating a tight-knit structure or community of people that you are going to spend the majority of your time with, if they're all doing that as well, then you're naturally going to start doing that. So you need to be intentional about who you put yourself around right off the bat. Think about veterans that have already gone through the process, that are already where you want to be, so you can learn from them and start getting that mindset change. Because you were brainwashed going into the military to get that mindset, you need to be brainwashed coming out to get back into the swing of things.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Those are probably the two most important. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the parallels with the yachting industry as well. And often it's like becomes a revolving door because they don't know what their sense of purpose is and they are used to a particular lifestyle and it's predominantly a lavish lifestyle. So then when you go back to land and it's like, whoa, I've got all these financial responsibilities and I don't know what my vocation is in life. And that's why I've created this course called Design the Life That You Love to help them with that transition, because purpose is key, as you said, and that's part of mental health is, you know, you need to have something to wake up for in the morning. Otherwise, what's the point? It becomes a hard slog. So with regards to your business, what are you hoping to achieve?
I am a visionary, and so I have really big plans, and it is worldwide. I had done a international speaking tour in Europe, and I'm hoping to do it again after all of this, all the crisis stuff going on right now is done. So I'm really hoping to do that. And I know I mentioned I would love to expand that to Australia. Yeah. So I've heard so many of my friends have gone there and they just have fallen in love with it. And so I've only heard good things, except for all the poisonous stuff. So, you know, being able to really reach out to more people is what it comes down to. The bigger the vision, the more people you can help. And so instead of helping people on, you know, a 10s and 20s and 30s level basis, you're helping people on hundreds of people, or on the level of thousands of people. And so my business essentially, the vision for it is going to be big enough to help thousands of people. And that means that I can't be the magic. The information has to be the magic. I have to have other coaches working for me to be able to reach that many people. We need to be building summits and conferences and something where we can leverage a program or a time to be able to help others. And that's why I'm building a membership course for veterans all around the world right now, to be able to focus and learn this communication and this leadership strategy, because you can leverage the internet so well nowadays, and you can reach so many more people and help so many more people if you know how to use it. You don't have to trade time for money and be restricted to a max of 12 people at a time, right?
Yes.
So, yeah.
And I think being in a service-based business, that's what we want to do. We want to make a massive impact. And that's probably the same feeling or sentiments that I have, is because there's only one of me right now, and I can't do one-on-ones, you know, for the rest of my life, because I won't have the time. I'll reach capacity, and I feel sorry for the other people that will miss out on these services. So I think, you know, being able to deliver your resources in a way that can reach thousands and thousands of people is fantastic.
Yes, I agree completely. And in a weird way, if you want to think about it this way, you almost have a duty to do that. Yeah. And if you don't keep scaling, if you don't keep thinking about a bigger vision, it's almost like it's your fault that those people are not getting information that can help them.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's almost like a duty of care.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Charisse, it's so lovely to connect with you, and I find your story so inspirational. I was telling my family this morning that I was speaking to you. That was really exciting.
I absolutely love talking to you. So
I'm
glad that you feel the same way.
Thank you. And yeah, thanks for coming on Yachting International Radio. I know it's late at night for yourself, but it's been an absolute pleasure.
Yes, you as well. Thanks for the time.